crypt. The terminal is supposed to echo the lines of a row of Malay longhouses jammed together side by side. A freshly painted jetway gropes out like a giant lamprey and slaps its neoprene lips onto the side of the plane. The elderly Nipponese tour group makes no effort to leave the plane, respectfully leaving the aisles clear for the businessmen. You go ahead. The people we're going to visit won't mind waiting. On his march up the jetway, humidity and jet fuel condense onto Randy's skin in equal measure, and he begins to sweat. Then he's in the terminal, which, notwithstanding the Malay Longhouse illusion, has been engineered specifically to look like any other brand-new airport terminal in the world. The air conditioning hits like a spike through the head. He puts his bags down on the floor and stands there for a moment, collecting his wits beneath a Leroy Nyman painting, the dimensions of a volleyball court, depicting the Sultan in action on a polo pony. Trapped in a window seat during a short and choppy flight, he had never made it out to the lavatory. So he goes to one now and pees so hard that the urinal emits a sort of yodeling noise. As he steps back, perfectly satisfied, he becomes conscious of a man backing away from an adjacent urinal, one of the Nipponese businessmen who just got off the plane. A couple of months ago, the presence of this man would have ruled out Randy's taking a leak at all. Today, he didn't even notice that the guy was there. As a longtime bashful kidney sufferer, Randy is delighted to have stumbled upon the magic remedy. Not to convince yourself that you are a dominating alpha male, but rather to be too lost in your thoughts to notice other people around you. Bashful kidney is your body's way of telling you that you are thinking too hard, that you need to get off the campus and go get a fucking job.
You are looking at the Ministry of Information site? The businessman says.
He is in a perfect charcoal gray pinstripe suit, which he wears just as easily and comfortably as Randy does his souvenir t-shirt from the 5th Hackers Conference, Surfer's Jams, and Teva Sandals.
Oh, Randy blurts, annoyed with himself. I completely forgot to look for it.
Both men laugh. The Nipponese man produces a business card with some deft sleight of hand. Randy has to rip open his nylon and Velcro wallet and delve for his. They exchange cards in the traditional Asian two-handed style, which Avi has forced Randy to practice until he gets it nearly right. They bow at each other, triggering howls from the nearest couple of computerized self-flushing urinals. The bathroom door swings open and an aged Nip wanders in, a precursor of the Silver Horde. Nip is the word used by Sergeant Sean Daniel McGee, U.S. Army retired, to refer to Nipponese people in his war memoir about Kinakuta, a photocopy of which document Randy is carrying in his bag. It is a terrible racist slur. On the other hand, people call British people Brits and Yankees Yanks all the time. Calling a Nipponese person a Nip is just the same thing, isn't it? Or is it tantamount to calling a Chinese person a chink? During the hundreds of hours of meetings and megabytes of encrypted email messages that Randy, Abby, John Cantrell, Tom Howard, Eberhard Fur, and Beryl have exchanged, getting Epiphyte 2 off the ground, each of them has occasionally, inadvertently, used the word Jap as shorthand for Japanese, in the same way as they used RAM to mean random access memory. But of course, Jap is a horrible racist slur, too. Randy figures it all has to do with your state of mind at the time you utter the word. If you're just trying to abbreviate, it's not a slur. But if you are fomenting racist hatreds, as Sean Daniel McGee occasionally seems to be not above doing, that's different. This particular Nipponese individual is identified on his card as Goto Furudenendu, Ferdinand Goto. Randy, who has spent a lot of time recently puzzling over organizational charts of certain important Nipponese corporations, knows already that he is a vice president for special projects, whatever that means, at Goto Engineering. He also knows that organizational charts of Nipponese companies are horseshit and that job titles mean absolutely nothing. That he has the same surname as the guy who founded the company is presumably worth taking note of. Randy's card says that he is Randall L. Waterhouse, Randy, and that he is Vice President for Network Technology Development at Epiphyte Corporation.
Goto and Waterhouse stroll out of the washroom and start to follow the baggage claim icons that are strung across the terminal like breadcrumbs.
You have jet lag now?
Goto asks brightly, following, Randy assumes, a script from an English textbook. He's a handsome guy with a winning smile. He's probably in his 40s, though Nipponese people seem to have a whole different aging algorithm, so this might be way off.
No, Randy answers.
Being a nerd, he answers such questions badly, succinctly, and truthfully. He knows that Goto essentially does not care whether Randy has jet lag or not. He is vaguely conscious that Avi, if he were here, would use Goto's question as it was intended, as an opening for cheery social banter. Until he reached 30, Randy felt bad about the fact that he was not socially deft. Now he doesn't give a damn. Pretty soon he'll probably start being proud of it. In the meantime, just for the sake of the common enterprise, he tries his best.
I've actually been in Manila for several days, so I've had plenty of time to adjust.
Ah, did your activities in Manila go well?
Goto fires back.
Yes, very well, thank you.
Randy lies, now that his social skills, such as they are, have had a moment to get unlimbered.
Did you come directly from Tokyo?
Goto's smile freezes in place for a moment, and he hesitates before saying,
Yes.
This is, at root, a patronizing reply. Goto Engineering is headquartered in Kobe, and they would not fly out of the Tokyo airport. Goto said yes anyway because, during that moment of hesitation, he realized that he was just dealing with a Yank who, when he said Tokyo, really meant the Nipponese home islands, or wherever the hell you come from.
Excuse me, Randy says. I meant to say Osaka.
Goto grins brilliantly and seems to execute a tiny suggestion of a bow.
Yes, I came from Osaka today.
Goto and Waterhouse drift apart from each other at the luggage claim, exchange grins as they breeze through immigration, and run into each other at the ground transportation section. Kinakutan men in brilliant white quasi-naval uniforms with gold braid and white gloves are buttonholing passengers, proffering transportation to the local hotels.
You are staying at the Foot Mansion also?
Goto says. That being the luxury hotel in Kinakuta. But he knows the answer already. Tomorrow's meeting has been planned as exhaustively as a space shuttle launch. Randy hesitates. The largest Mercedes-Benz he's ever seen has just pulled up to the curb, condensed moisture not merely fogging its windows but running down them in literal streamlines. A driver in Foot Mansion livery has erupted from it to divest Mr. Goto of his luggage. Randy knows that he need only make a subtle move toward that car and he will be whisked to a luxury hotel where he can take a shower, watch TV naked while drinking a $100 bottle of French wine, go swimming, get a massage. Which is precisely the problem. He can already feel himself wilting in the equatorial heat. It's too early to go soft. He's only been awake for 6 or 7 hours. There's work to be done. He forces himself to stand up at attention, and the effort makes him break a sweat so palpably that he almost expects to moisten everything within a radius of several meters.
I would enjoy sharing a ride to the hotel with you, he says, but I have one or two errands to run first.
Goto understands.
Perhaps drinks this evening.
Leave me a message, Randy says.
Then Goto's waving at him through the smoked glass of the Mercedes as it pulls 7 G's away from the curb. Randy does a 180, goes back inside to the halal Dunkin' Donuts, which accepts 8 currencies, and sates himself. Then he reemerges and turns imperceptibly toward a line of taxis. A driver hurls himself bodily towards Randy and tears his garment bag loose from his shoulder.
A Ministry of Information, Randy says.
In the long run, it may or may not be a good idea for the Sultanate of Kinakuta to have a gigantic earthquake, volcano, tsunami, and thermonuclear weapon-proof Ministry of Information with a cavernous sub-sub-basement crammed with high-powered computers and data switches, but the Sultan has decided that it would be sort of cool. He has hired some alarming Germans to design it and Goto Engineering to build it.
No one, of course, is more familiar with staggering natural disasters than the Nipponese, with the possible exception of some peoples who are now extinct, and therefore unable to bid on jobs like this. They also know a thing or two about having the shit bombed out of them, as do the Germans. There are subcontractors, of course, and a plethora of consultants. Through some miraculous feat of fast-talking, Abby managed to land one of the biggest consulting contracts. Epiphyte II Corporation is doing systems integration work, which means plugging together a bunch of junk made by other people and overseeing the installation of all the computers, switches, and data lines. The drive to the site is surprisingly short. Kinakuta City isn't that big, hemmed in as it is by steep mountain ranges, and the Sultan has endowed it with plenty of 8-lane superhighways. The taxi blasts across the plain of reclaimed land on which the airport is built, swings wide around the stump of Eliza Peak, ignoring two exits for Technology City, then turns off at an unmarked exit. Suddenly, they are stuck in a queue of empty dump trucks. Nipponese behemoths, emblazoned with the word Goto in fat, macho block letters. Coming towards them is a stream of other trucks that are identical except that these are fully laden with stony rubble. The taxi driver pulls onto the right shoulder and zooms past trucks for about half a mile. They're heading up. Randy's ears pop once. This road is built on the floor of a ravine that climbs up into one of the mountain ranges. Soon they are hemmed in by vertiginous walls of green, which act like a sponge, trapping an eternal cloud of mist through which sparks of brilliant color are sometimes visible. Randy can't tell whether they are birds or flowers. The contrast between the cloud forests, lush vegetation, and the dirt road, battered by the house-sized tires of the heavy trucks, is disorienting. The taxi stops. The driver turns and looks at him expectantly. Randy thinks for a moment that the driver has gotten lost and is looking to Randy for instructions. The road terminates here, in a parking lot mysteriously placed in the middle of the cloud forest. Randy sees half a dozen big air-conditioned trailers bearing the logos of various Nipponese, German, and American firms, a couple of dozen cars, as many buses. All the accoutrements of a major construction site are here, plus a few extras, like two monkeys with giant stiff penises fighting over some booty from a dumpster. But there is no construction site. Just a wall of green at the end of the road. Green so dark it's almost black. The empty trucks are disappearing into that darkness. Full ones come out, their headlights emerging from the mist and gloom first, followed by the colorful displays that the drivers have built onto the radiator grills, followed by the highlights on their chrome and glass, and finally the trucks themselves. Randy's eyes adjust, and he can see now that he is staring into a cavern, lit up by mercury vapor lamps. "You want me to wait?" the driver asks. Randy glances at the meter, does a quick conversion, and figures out that the ride to this point has cost him a dime. "Yes," he says, and gets out of the taxi. Satisfied, the driver kicks back and lights up a cigarette. Randy stands there and gapes into the cavern for a minute, partly because it's a hell of a thing to look at, and partly because a river of cool air is draining out of it, which feels good. Then he trudges across the lot and goes to the trailer marked Epiphyte. It is staffed by three tiny Kinakutan women who know exactly who he is, though they've never met him before, and who give every indication of being delighted to see him. They wear long, loose wraps of brilliantly colored fabric on top of Eddie Bauer turtlenecks to ward off the Nordic chill of the air conditioners. They are all fearsomely efficient and poised. Everywhere Randy goes in Southeast Asia, he runs into women who ought to be running General Motors or something. Before long, they have sent out word of his arrival via walkie-talkie and cell phone, and presented him with a pair of thick knee-high boots, a hard hat, and a cellular phone, all carefully labeled with his name. After a couple of minutes, a young Kinakutan man in hard hat and muddy boots opens the trailer's door, introduces himself as Steve, and leads Randy into the entrance of the cavern. They follow a narrow pedestrian boardwalk, illuminated by a string of caged light bulbs. For the first 100 meters or so, the cave is just a straight passage barely wide enough to admit 2 Goto trucks and the pedestrian lane. Randy trails his hand along the wall. The stone is rough and dusty, not smooth like the surface of a natural cavern, and he can see fresh gouges wrought by jackhammers and drills. He can tell by the echo that something's about to change. Steve leads him out into the cavern proper. It is, well, cavernous. Big enough for a dozen of the huge trucks to pull around in a circle to be laden with rock and muck. Randy looks up, trying to find the ceiling, but all he sees is a pattern of bluish-white high-intensity lights, like the ones in gymnasiums, perhaps 10 meters above. Beyond that, it's darkness and mist. Steve goes off in search of something and leaves Randy alone for a few minutes, which is useful, since it takes a long time for him to get his bearings. Some of the cavern wall is smooth and natural. The rest of it is rough, marking the enlargements conceived by the engineers and executed by the contractor. Likewise, some of the floor is smooth and not quite level. Some places it has been drilled and blasted to bring it down, others it has been filled in to bring it up. This, the main chamber, looks to be about finished. The offices of the Ministry of Information will be here. There are 2 other smaller chambers deeper inside the mountain, still being enlarged. One will contain the engineering plant, power generators, and so forth, and the other will be the systems unit. A burly blond man in a white hard hat emerges from a hole in the chamber wall. Tom Howard, Epify Corporation's Vice President for Systems Technology. He takes his hard hat off and waves to Randy, then beckons him over. The passageway that leads to the systems chamber is big enough that you could drive a delivery van down it, but it's not as straight or as level as the main entryway. It is mostly occupied by a conveyor system of terrifying power and speed, which is carrying tons of dripping gray muck out towards the main chamber to be dumped into the Goto trucks. In terms of apparent cost and sophistication, it bears the same relationship to a normal conveyor belt as an F-15 does to a Sopwith Camel. It is possible to speak, but impossible to be heard when you are near it. And so Tom and Randy and the Kinnikutin, who calls himself Steve, trudge silently down the passage for another 100 or so meters until they reach the next cavern. This one is only large enough to contain a modest 1-story house. The conveyor passes right through the middle of it and disappears down another hole. The muck is coming from deeper yet in the mountain. It's still too loud in here to talk. The floor has been leveled by pouring in concrete, and conduits rise from it every few meters with orange cables dangling from their open tops, optical fiber lines. Tom walks towards another opening in the wall. It appears that several subsidiary caverns branch away from this one. Tom leads Randy through the opening, then turns to put a hand on his arm and steady him. They are at the top of a steep wooden staircase that has been built down a nearly vertical shaft that descends a good 5 meters or so.
"What you just saw is the main switch room," Tom says. "That'll be the largest router in the world when it's finished. We're using some of these other chambers to install computers and mass storage systems. The world's largest RAID, basically, buffered with a big, big RAM cache."
RAID means Redundant Array of Inexpensive Disks. It is a way to store vast quantities of information cheaply and reliably, and exactly the kind of thing you would want to have in a data haven.
"So we're still cleaning out some of these other chambers," Tom continues. "We discovered something down here that I thought you'd find interesting."
He turns around and begins to descend the staircase.
"Did you know that these caves were used as an air raid shelter by the Japanese during the war?"
Randy has been carrying the map page from his photocopied book around in his pocket. He unfolds it and holds it up near a light bulb. Sure enough, it includes a site up in the mountains, labeled Entrance to Air Raid Shelter and Command Post.
"And a command post?" Randy says.
"Yeah, how'd you know that?"
"Interlibrary loan," Randy says. We didn't know it until we got here and found all of these old cables and electrical shit strung around the place. We had to tear it out so we could string in our own.
Randy begins to descend the steps.
This shaft was full of rocks, Tom says. But we could see wires going down into it, so we knew something had to be down here.
Randy looks nervously at the ceiling.
Why was it full of rocks? Was there a cave-in? No, Tom says. The Japanese soldiers did it. They threw rocks down the shaft until it was full. It took a dozen of our laborers 2 weeks to pull all the rocks out by hand. So what did the wires lead to? Light bulbs, Tom says. They were just electrical wires, no communications. Then what was it they were trying to hide down here? Randy asks.
He has almost reached the bottom of the staircase, and he can see that there is a room-sized cavity.
See for yourself, Tom says,
and flicks a light switch. The cavity is about the size of a one-car garage, with a nice level floor. There is a wooden desk, chair, and filing cabinet, fuzzy with 50 years' growth of gray-green fungus. And there is a metal footlocker, painted olive drab, stenciled with Nipponese characters.
I forced the lock on this thing, Tom says.
He steps over to the footlocker and flips the lid open. It is filled with books.
You were expecting maybe gold bars?
Tom says, laughing at the expression on Randy's face. Randy sits down on the floor and grabs his ankles. He's staring open-mouthed at the books in the chest.
You okay? Tom asks.
Heavy, heavy deja vu, Randy says.
From this?
Yeah, Randy says. I've seen this before.
Where?
In my grandmother's attic.
Randy finds his way up out of the network of caverns and into the parking lot. The warm air feels good on his skin, but by the time he has reached the Epiphyte Corp trailer to turn in his hard hat and boots, he has begun to sweat again. He bids goodbye to the three women who work there and once again is struck by their attentiveness, their solicitousness. Then he remembers that he is not just some interloper. He is a shareholder and an important officer in the corporation that employs them. He is paying them or oppressing them. Take your pick. He trudges across the parking lot, moving very slowly, trying not to get that metabolic furnace head up. A second taxi is pulled alongside the one that is waiting for Randy, and the drivers are leaning out of their windows, shooting the breeze. As Randy approaches his taxi, he happens to glance back towards the entrance of the cavern. Framed in its dark maw and dwarfed by the mountainous shapes of the Goto dump trucks is a solitary man, silver-haired, stooped, but trim and almost athletic-looking, in a warm-up suit and sneakers. He is standing with his back to Randy, facing the cavern, holding a long spray of flowers. He seems rooted in the mud, perfectly motionless. The front door of the Goto engineering trailer flies open. A young Nipponese man in a white shirt, striped tie, and orange hard hat descends the stairs and moves briskly towards the old man with the flowers. When he is still some distance away, he stops, puts his feet together, and executes a bow. Randy hasn't spent enough time around Nipponese to understand the minutiae, but this looks to him like an extraordinarily major bow. He approaches the old man with a bright smile and holds one beckoning hand out towards the Goto trailer. The old man seems disoriented. Maybe the cavern doesn't look like it used to, but after a few moments, he returns a perfunctory bow and allows the young engineer to lead him out of the stream of traffic. Randy gets in his taxi and says, "Foot Mansion," to the driver. He has been harboring an illusion that he will read Sean Daniel McGee's war memoir slowly and thoroughly from beginning to end, but this has now gone the way of all illusions. He hauls the photocopied stack out of his bag during the drive to the hotel and begins ruthless triage. Most of it has nothing to do with Kinakuta at all. It's about McGee's experiences fighting in New Guinea and the Philippines. McGee is no Churchill, but he does have a distant, Blarney-tinged narrative talent, which makes even banal anecdotes readable. His skills as raconteur must have made him a big hit around the bar at the NCO's club.
100 tipsy sergeants must have urged him to write some of this shit down if he ever made it back to South Boston alive. He did make it back. But unlike most of the other GIs who were in the Philippines on VJ Day, he didn't go straight back home. He took a little detour to the Sultanate of Kinakuta, which was still home to almost 4,000 Nipponese troops. This explains an oddity about his book. In most war memoirs, VE Day or VJ Day happens on the last page, or at least in the last chapter, and then our narrator goes home and buys a Buick. But VJ Day happens about two-thirds of the way through Sean Daniel McGee's book. When Randy sets aside the pre-August 1945 material, an ominously thick stack of pages remains. Clearly, Sergeant McGee has something to get off his chest. The Nipponese garrison on Kinakuta had long since been bypassed by the war, and like other bypassed garrisons, had turned what energies they had left to vegetable farming and waiting for the extremely sporadic arrivals of submarines, which, towards the close of the war, the Nipponese used to haul the most extremely vital cargo and to ferry certain desperately needed specialists, like airplane mechanics, from one place to another. When they got Hirohito's broadcast from Tokyo ordering them to lay down their arms, they did so dutifully, but, one has to suspect, gladly. The only hard part was finding someone to surrender to. The Allies had concentrated on planning the invasion of the Nipponese home islands, and it took them a while to get troops out to the bypassed garrisons like Kinakuta. McGee's account of the confusion in Manila is mordant. At this point in the book, McGee starts to lose his patience and his charm. He starts to rail. 20 pages later, he's sloshing ashore at Kinakuta City. He stands at attention while his company captain accepts the surrender of the Nipponese garrison. He posts a guard around the entrance to the cavern where a few diehard Nips have refused to surrender. He organizes the systematic disarming of the Nipponese soldiers, who are terribly emaciated, and sees to it that their rifles and ammunition are dumped into the ocean even as food and medical supplies are brought ashore. He helps a small contingent of engineers string barbed wire around the airfield, turning it into an internment camp. Randy flips through all of this during the drive to the hotel. Then words like impaled and screams and hideous catch his eye, so he flips back a few pages and begins to read more carefully. The upshot is that the Nipponese had, since 1940, marched thousands of tribesmen out of the cool, clean interior of the island to its hot, pestilential edge and put them to work. These slaves had enlarged the big cavern where the Nipponese built their air raid shelter and command post, improved the road to the top of Eliza Peak, where the radar and direction-finding stations were perched, built another runway at the airfield, filled in more of the harbor, and died by thousands of malaria, scrub typhus, dysentery, starvation, and overwork. These same tribesmen, or their bereaved brothers, had then watched from their redoubts high in the mountains as Sean Daniel McGee and his comrades came and stripped the Nipponese of their armaments and concentrated them all in the airfield, guarded by a few dozen exhausted GIs who were frequently drunk or asleep. Those tribesmen worked around the clock up there in the jungle making spears, until the next full moon illuminated the sleeping Nipponese like a searchlight. Then they poured out of the forest in what Sean Daniel McGee describes as a horde, a plague of wasps, a howling army, a black legion unleashed from the gates of hell, a screaming mass, and in other ways he could never get away with now. They flattened and disarmed the GIs, but did not hurt them. They flung tree limbs over the barbed wire until the fence had become a highway, and then swarmed into the airfield with their spears at the ready. McGee's account goes on for about 20 pages, and as much as anything else, is the story of the night that one affable sergeant from South Boston became permanently unhinged.
Sir?
Randy is startled to realize that the taxi's door is open. He looks around and finds that he's under the awning of the Hotel Foot Mansion. The door is being held open for him by a wiry young bellhop with a different look than most of the Kinakutans Randy has encountered so far. This kid perfectly matches Sean Daniel McGee's description of a tribesman from the interior.
Thank you, Randy says,
and makes a point of tipping the fellow generously. His room is all done up in furniture designed in Scandinavia, but assembled locally from various endangered hardwoods. The view is towards the interior mountains, but if he goes onto his tiny balcony, he can see a bit of water, a container ship being unloaded, and most of the memorial garden built by the Nipponese on the site of the massacre. Several messages and faxes await him, mostly the other members of Epiphyte Corp, notifying him that they have arrived and letting him know in which room they can be found. Randy unpacks his bags, takes a shower, and sends his shirts down to the laundry for tomorrow. Then he makes himself comfortable at his little table, boots his laptop, and pulls up the Epiphyte II Corporation business plan. Lizard. Bobby Shafto and his buddies are just out for a nice little morning drive through the countryside. In Italy.
Italy! He cannot fucking believe it! What gives?
Not his job to know. His job has been very clearly described to him. It has to be clearly described because it makes no sense. In the good old days, back on Guadalcanal, his commanding officer would say something like,
Shafto, eradicate that pillbox!
And from there on out, Bobby Shafto was a free agent. He could walk, run, swim, or crawl. He could sneak up and lob in a satchel charge, or he could stand off at a distance and hose the objective down with a flamethrower. Didn't matter as long as he accomplished the goal. The goal of this little mission is completely beyond Shafto's comprehension. They awaken him, Lieutenant Enoch Root, three of the other Marines, including the radio man, and several of the SAS blokes in the middle of the night, and hustled them down to one of the few docks in Malta that hasn't been blasted away by the Luftwaffe. A submarine waits. They climb aboard and play cards for about 24 hours. Most of the time they are on the surface, where submarines can go a hell of a lot faster, but from time to time they dive, evidently for the best of reasons. When next they are allowed up on the flat top of the submarine, it is the middle of the night again. They are in a little cove in a parched, rugged coastline. Shafto can see that much by the moonlight. Two trucks are waiting for them. They open hatches in the sub's deck and begin to take stuff out. Into one of the trucks, the U.S. Marines load a bunch of cloth sacks bulging with what appears to be all kinds of trash. Meanwhile, the British Special Air Service are at work with wrenches, rags, grease, and much profanity in the back of the other truck, assembling something from crates that they have brought up from another part of the submarine. This is covered up by a tarp before Shafto can get a good look, but he recognizes it as something you'd rather have pointed away from you. There are a couple of dark men with mustachios hanging around the dock, smoking and arguing with the skipper of the submarine. After all of the stuff is unloaded, the skipper appears to pay them with more crates from the submarine. The men pry a couple of them open for inspection and appear to be satisfied. At this point, Shafto still doesn't even know what continent they are on. When he first saw the landscape, he figured Northern Africa. When he saw the men, he figured Turkey or something. It is not until the sun comes up on their little convoy, and lying in the back of the truck on top of the sacks of trash, peeking out from under the tarp, he is able to see road signs and Christian churches, that he realizes it has to be Italy or Spain. Finally, he sees a sign pointing the way to Roma and figures it's Italy. The sign points away from the mid-morning sun, so they must be somewhere south or southeast of Rome. They are also south of some burg called Napoli. But he doesn't spend a lot of time looking. It is not encouraged. The truck is being driven by some fellow who speaks the language and who stops from time to time to converse with the natives. Some of the time, this sounds like friendly banter. Sometimes it sounds like arguments over highway etiquette. Sometimes it is quieter, more guarded. Shafto figures out, slowly, that during these exchanges, the truck driver is bribing someone to let them go through. He finds it shocking that in a country actively embroiled in the middle of the greatest war in history, in a country run by belligerent fascists, for God's sake, two truckloads of heavily armed enemy soldiers can just drive around freely, protected by nothing except a couple of $5 tarps. Criminy! What kind of a sorry operation is this? He feels like leaping to his feet, casting the tarp aside and giving these eye ties a good dressing down. The whole place needs a good scrubbing with toothbrushes anyway.
It's like these people aren't even trying.
Now, the Nips, think of them what you will, at least when those guys declare war on you, they mean it.
He resists the temptation to upbraid the Italians. He thinks it goes against the orders he had thoroughly memorized before the shock of figuring out that he was driving around in an Axis country jangled everything loose from his brain. And if they hadn't come from the lips of Colonel Chatton himself, the chap or bloke who's the commanding officer of Detachment 2702, he wouldn't have believed them anyway. They're going to be putting in some bivouac time. They're going to play a lot of cards for a while. During this time, the radio man is going to be very busy. This phase of the operation might last as long as a week. At some point, it is likely that strenuous concerted efforts to kill them will be made by a whole lot of Germans, and if they happen to be feeling impetuous that day, Italians. When this happens, they are to send out a radio message, torch the joint, drive to a certain field that passes for an airstrip, and be picked up by those jaunty SAS flyboys. Shafto didn't believe a word of it at first. He pegged it as some kind of British humor thing, some kind of practical joke hazing ritual. In general, he doesn't know what to make of the Brits because they appear, in his personal observation, to be the only other people on the face of the earth, besides Americans, who possess a sense of humor. He has heard rumors that some East Europeans can do it, but he hasn't met any of them, and they don't have much to yuck it up about at the moment. In any case, he can never quite make out when these Brits are joking. Any thought that this was just a joke evaporated when he saw the quantity of armaments they were being issued. Shafto has found out, for an organization devoted to shooting and blowing up people on a large scale, the military is infuriatingly reticent about passing out weapons. And most of the weapons they do pass out are for shit. It is for this reason that Marines have long found it necessary to buy their own Tommy guns from home. The Corps wants them to kill people, but they just won't give them the stuff they need. But this Detachment 2702 thing is a whole different outfit. Even the grunts are carrying trench brooms. And if that didn't get their attention, the cyanide capsules sure did. And the lecture from Chatton on the correct way to blow your own head off? You would be astonished at how many otherwise competent chaps botch this apparently simple procedure. Now, Shafto realizes that there is an unspoken codicil to Chatton's orders. Oh yeah, and if any of the Italians who actually live in Italy and who run the place and who are fascists and who are at war with us, if any of them notice you and for some reason object to your little plan, whatever the fuck it is, then by all means, kill them. And if that doesn't work, please, by all means, kill yourself, because you'll probably do a neater job of it than the fascists will. Don't forget suntan lotion. Actually, Shafto doesn't mind this mission. It is certainly no worse than Guadalcanal. What bothers him, he decides, making himself comfortable on the sacks of mysterious trash, staring up at a crack in the tarp, is not understanding the purpose of it all. The rest of the platoon may or may not be dead. He thinks he can still hear some of them crying out, but it's hard to tell between the pounding of the incoming surf and the relentless patter of the machine gun. Then he realizes that some of them must be alive, or else the Nips would not continue to fire their gun. Shafto knows that he is closer to the gun than any of his buddies. He is the only one who has a chance. It is at this point that Shafto makes his big decision. It is surprisingly easy, but then really stupid decisions are always the easiest. He crawls along the log to the point that is closest to the machine gun. Then he draws a few deep breaths in a row, rises to a crouch, and vaults over the log. He has a clear view of the cave entrance now, the comet-shaped muzzle flash of the machine gun tessellated by the black grid of the net that they put up to reject incoming grenades. It is all remarkably clear. He looks back over the beach and sees motionless corpses. Suddenly he realizes they are still firing the gun not because any of his buddies are alive, but to use up all of their excess ammunition so that they will not have to pack it out. Shafto is a grunt and understands. Then the muzzle swings abruptly towards him. He has been sighted. He is in the clear, totally exposed. He can dive into the jungle foliage, but they will sweep it with fire until he is dead. Bobby Shafto plants his feet,
aims his .45 into the cave and begins pulling the trigger. The barrel of the machine gun is pointing at him now. But it does not fire. His .45 clicks. It's empty. Everything is silent except for the surf and for the screaming. Shafto holsters his .45 and pulls out his revolver. The voice that is doing the screaming is unfamiliar. It's not one of Shafto's buddies. A Nipponese Imperial Marine bolts from the mouth of the cave, up above the level of Shafto's head. The pupil of Shafto's right eye, the sights of his revolver, and this nip are all arranged briefly along the same line for a moment, during which Shafto pulls the trigger a couple of times and almost certainly scores a hit. The Imperial Marine gets caught in the netting and plunges to the ground in front of him. A second nip dives out of the cave a moment later, grunting incoherently, apparently speechless with horror. He lands wrong and breaks one of his leg bones. Shafto can hear it snap. He begins running towards the surf anyway, hobbling grotesquely on the bad leg. He completely ignores Shafto. There is terrible bleeding from his neck and shoulder, and loose chunks of flesh flopping around as he runs. Bobby Shafto holsters his revolver. He ought to shoulder his rifle and plug the guy, but he is too confused to do anything for the moment. Something red flickers in the mouth of the cave. He glances up that way and sees nothing clear enough to register against the deafening visual noise of the jungle. Then he sees the flash of red again, and it disappears again. It was shaped like a sharpened Y. It was shaped like the forked tongue of a reptile. Then a moving slab of living jungle explodes from the mouth of the cave and crashes into the foliage below. The tops of the plants shake and topple as it moves. It is out, free and clear, on the beach. It is low to the ground, moving on all fours. It pauses for a moment and flicks its tongue towards the Imperial Marine, who is now hobbling into the Pacific Ocean some 50 feet distant. Sand erupts into the air like smoke from the burning tires of a drag racer, and the lizard is rocketing across the beach. It covers the distance to the Imperial Marine in 1, 2, 3 seconds, takes him in the backs of the knees, takes him down hard into the surf. Then the lizard is dragging the dead nip back up onto the land. It stretches him out there among the dead Americans, walks around him a couple of times, flicking its tongue, and finally starts to eat him.
"Sarge, we're here,"
says Private Flanagan. Before he even wakes up, Bobby Shafto notices that Flanagan is speaking in a normal voice and does not sound scared or excited. Wherever "here" is, it's not someplace dangerous. They are not under attack. Shafto opens his eyes just as the tarp is being peeled back from the open top of the truck. He stares straight up into a blue Italian sky, torn around the edges by the scrabbling branches of desperate trees.
"Shit,"
he says.
"What's wrong, Sarge?"
"I just always say that when I wake up,"
Shafto says. Their new home turns out to be an old stone farm building in an olive farm, plantation, orchard, or whatever the fuck you call a place where olives are grown. If this building were in Wisconsin, any cheesehead who passed by would peg it as abandoned. Here, Shafto is not so sure. The roof is partly collapsed into the building under the killing weight of its red clay tiles, and the windows and doorways yawn, open to the elements. It's a big structure, big enough that after several hours of sledgehammer work, they are able to drive one of the trucks inside and conceal it from airborne troops. They unload the sacks of trash from the other truck. Then the Italian guy drives it away and never comes back. Corporal Benjamin, the radio man, gets busy clambering up olive trees and stringing copper wires around the place. The blokes of the SAS go out and reconnoiter while the guys of the Marine Corps open the sacks of trash and start spreading them around. There are several months' worth of Italian newspapers. All of them have been opened, rearranged, haphazardly refolded. Articles have been torn out. Other articles circled or annotated in pencil. Chatton's orders are beginning to filter back into Shafto's brain. He heaps these newspapers in the corners of the barn, oldest ones first, newer ones on top. There is a whole sack filled with cigarette butts, carefully smoked to the nub. They're of a continental brand unfamiliar to Shafto. Like a farmer broadcasting seeds, he carries this sack around the premises, tossing handfuls onto the ground, concentrating mostly on places where people will actually work. Corporal Benjamin's table and another makeshift table they have set up for eating and playing poker. Likewise, with a salad of wine corks and beer caps. An equal number of wine and beer bottles are flung one by one into a dark and unused corner of the barn. Bobby Shafto can see that this is the most satisfying work he will ever get, so he takes it over and flings those bottles like a Green Bay Packer quarterback firing spiral passes into the sure hands of his plucky tight ends. The blokes come back from reconnoitering, and there is a swappage of roles. The Marines now go out to familiarize themselves with the territory, while the SAS continue unloading garbage. In an hour's worth of wandering around, Sergeant Shafto and Privates Flanagan and Kuhl determine that this olive ranch is on a long, skinny shelf of land that runs roughly north-south. To the west, the territory rises up steeply toward a conical peak that looks suspiciously like a volcano. To the east, it drops, after a few miles, down towards the sea. To the north, the plateau dead-ends in some nasty, impassable scrubland, and to the south, it opens up on more farming territory. Chatton wanted him to find a vantage point on the bay as convenient as possible to the barn. Toward sunset, Shafto finds it, a rocky outcropping on the slopes of the volcano, half an hour's walk northeast of the barn and maybe 500 feet above it in altitude. He and his Marines almost don't find their way back to the barn because it has been so well hidden by this point. The SAS have put up blackout shades over every opening, even the small chinks in the collapsed roof. On the inside, they have settled in comfortably to the pockets of usable space. With all of the litter, now enhanced with chicken feathers and bones, tonsorial trimmings, and orange peels, it looks like they've been living there for a year, which Shafto guesses is the whole point. Corporal Benjamin has about a third of the place to himself. The SAS blokes keep calling him a lucky sod. He has his transmitter set up now, the tubes glowing warmly, and he has an unbelievable amount of paperwork. Most of it's old and fake, just like the cigarette butts. But after dinner, when the sun is down not only here but in London, he begins tapping out the Morse code. Shafto knows Morse code, like everyone else in the place. As the guys and the blokes sit around the table, anting up for what promises to be an all-night hearts marathon, they keep one ear cocked toward Corporal Benjamin's keying. What they hear is gibberish. Shafto goes and looks over Benjamin's shoulder at one point just to verify that he isn't crazy and sees he's right. XYHELANAOGGFQPLTWPKIAOEUT. And so on and so forth for pages and pages. The next morning they dig a latrine and then proceed to fill it halfway with a couple of barrels of genuine U.S. mil-spec general issue 100% pure certified shit. As per Chatton's instructions, they pour the shit in a dollop at a time, throwing in handfuls of crumpled Italian newspapers after each dollop to make it look like it got there naturally. With the possible exception of being interviewed by Lieutenant Reagan, this is the worst non-violent job Shafto has ever had to do in the service of his country. He gives everyone the rest of the day off, except for Corporal Benjamin, who stays up until 2 in the morning banging out random gibberish. The next day they make the observation post look good. They take turns marching up there and back, up and back, up and back, wearing a trail into the ground, and they scatter some cigarette butts and beverage containers up there along with some general-issue shit and general-issue piss. Flanagan and Curl hump a footlocker up there and hide it in the lee of a volcanic rock. The locker contains books of silhouettes of various Italian and German naval and merchant ships, and similar spotter's guides for airplanes, as well as some binoculars, telescopes, and camera equipment, empty notepads and pencils. Even though Sergeant Bobby Shafto is for the most part running this show, he finds it uncannily difficult to arrange a moment alone with Lieutenant Enoch Root. Root has been avoiding him ever since their eventful flight on the Dakota. Finally, on about the 5th day, Shafto tricks him. He and a small contingent leave Root alone at the observation point, Then Shafto doubles back and traps him there. Rude is startled to see Shafto come back, but he doesn't get particularly upset. He lights up an Italian cigarette and offers Shafto one. Shafto finds, irritatingly enough, that he is the nervous one. Root's as cool as always.
Okay, Shafto says. What did you see? When you look through the papers we plan on the dead butcher, what did you see?
They were all written in German,
Root says.
Shit.
Fortunately, Root continues, I am somewhat familiar with the language.
Oh yeah, your mom was a kraut, right?
Yes, a medical missionary, Root says. In case that helps dispel any of your preconceptions about Germans.
And your dad was Dutch?
That is correct.
And they both ended up on Guadalcanal, why?
To help those who were in need.
Oh, yeah.
I also learned some Italian along the way. There's a lot of it going around in the church.
Fuck me, Shafto exclaims.
But my Italian is heavily informed by the Latin that my father insisted that I learn. So I would probably sound rather old-fashioned to the locals. In fact, I would probably sound like a 17th-century alchemist or something.
Could you sound like a priest? They'd eat that up.
If worst comes to worst, Root allows, I will try hitting them with some god talk and we'll see what happens. They both puff on their cigarettes and look out across the large body of water before them, which Shafto has learned is called the Bay of Naples.
Well, anyway,
Shafto says.
What did it say on those papers?
A lot of detailed information about military convoys between Palermo and Tunis, evidently stolen from classified German sources, Root says.
Old convoys, or
convoys that were still in the future, Root says calmly. Shafto finishes his cigarette and does not speak for a while. Finally, he says,
Fucking weird.
He stands up and begins walking back towards the barn.
The Castle. Just as Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse detrains, some rakehill hits him full in the face with a turn of brackish ice water. The barrage continues as he walks a gauntlet of bucket-slinging ne'er-do-wells. But then he realizes no one's there. This is just an intrinsic quality of the local atmosphere, like fog in London. The staircase that leads over the tracks to Utter Mowbray Terminal is enclosed with roof and walls, forming a gigantic organ pipe that resonates with an infrasonic throb as it is pummeled by wind and water. As he walks into the lower end of the staircase, the storm is suddenly peeled away from his face, and he is able to stand there for a moment and give this phenom the full appreciation it deserves. Wind and water have been whipped into an essentially random froth by the storm. A microphone held up in the air would register only white noise, a complete absence of information. But when that noise strikes the long tube of the staircase, it drives a physical resonance that manifests itself in Waterhouse's brain as a low hum. The physics of the tube extract a coherent pattern from meaningless noise. If only Alan were here. Waterhouse experiments by singing the harmonics of this low fundamental tone, octave, fifth, fourth, major third, and so on. Each one resonates in the staircase to a greater or lesser degree. It is the same series of notes made by a brass instrument. By hopping from one note to another, Waterhouse is able to play some passable bugle calls on the staircase. He does a pretty decent reveille.
Oh, how lovely!
He spins around. A woman is standing behind him, lugging a portmanteau the size of a hay bale. She is perhaps 50 years old, with the physique of a stove, and she had a nice new big city permanent until a few seconds ago when she stepped out of the train. Salt water is running down her face and neck and disappearing beneath her sturdy frock of gray tagum wool.
Ma'am,
Waterhouse says. Then he busies himself with hauling her portmanteau up to the top of the stairs. This puts the two of them, and all of their luggage, on a narrow covered bridge that leads across the tracks and into the terminal building. The bridge has windows in it, and Waterhouse suffers a nauseating attack of vertigo as he looks through them, and through the half inch of rain and salt water that is streaming down them at any given moment, towards the North Atlantic Ocean.
This major body of water is only a stone's throw away and is trying vigorously to get much closer. This must be an optical illusion, but the tops of the waves appear to be level with the plane on which they're standing, despite the fact that it's at least 20 feet off the ground. Each one of those waves must weigh as much as all of the freight trains in Great Britain combined, and they are rolling towards them relentlessly, simply hammering the living daylights out of the rocks. It all makes Waterhouse want to pitch a fit, fall down, and throw up. He plugs his ears.
Are you a bandsman, then, I take it?
The lady inquires. Waterhouse turns to look at her. Her gaze is darting back and forth around the front of his uniform, checking the insignia. Then she looks up into his face and gives him a grandmotherly smile. Waterhouse realizes in that instant that this woman is a German spy.
Holy cow!
Only in peacetime, ma'am, he says. The Navy has other uses now for men with good ears.
Oh, she exclaims. You listen to things, do you?
Waterhouse smiles. Ping, ping, he says, mimicking sonar.
Ah,
she says.
I am Harriet Quitt.
She holds out her hand. Hugh Hughes, Waterhouse says, and shakes.
Pleasure.
All mine.
You'll be needing a place to stay, I suppose.
She blushes ostentatiously.
Forgive me. I just assume you are bound for outer.
That's outer, as in outer Tagum. Right now, they are on inner Tagum.
Quite right, actually,
Waterhouse says. Like every other place in the British Isles, inner and outer Tagum represent a gross misnomer with ancient and probably comical origins. Inner Tagum is hardly even an island. It is joined to the mainland by a sandbar that used to come and go with the tides, but that has been beefed up with a causeway that carries a road and the railway line. Outer Tagum is 20 miles away.
My husband and I operate a small bed and breakfast, Mrs. Quirt says. We should be honored to have an Asdic man stay with us.
Asdic is simply the British acronym for what Yanks refer to as sonar, but every time the word is mentioned in the presence of Alan, he gets a naughty look on his face and goes on an unstoppable punning tear. So he ends up at the Quirt residence. Waterhouse and Mr. and Mrs. Quirt spend the evening huddled round the only source of heat, a coal-burning toaster that has been bricked into the socket of an old fireplace. Every so often, Mr. Quirt opens the door and pelts the ashes with a moat of coal. Mrs. Quirt ferries out the chow and spies on Waterhouse. She notices his slightly asymmetrical walk and manages to ferret out that he had a spot of polio at one point. He plays the organ. They have a pedal-powered harmonium in the parlor, and she remarks on that. Waterhouse first sees Outer Tagum through a scupper. He doesn't even know what a scupper is except a modality of vomiting. The ferry crew gave him and the other half-dozen passengers detailed vomiting instructions before they fought past the utter Mowbray breakwater. The salient point being that if you leaned over the rail, you would almost certainly be swept overboard. Much better to get down on all fours and aim at a scupper. But half the time when Waterhouse peers down one of these, he sees not water but some distant point on the horizon, or seagulls chasing the ferry, or the distinctive three-pronged silhouette of Outer Tagum. The prongs, called sigras, are basaltic columns. This being the middle of the Second World War, and Outer Tagum being the part of the British Isles closest to the action of the Battle of the Atlantic, they are now flecked with little white radio shacks and hairy with antennas. There is a fourth sigra, much lower than the others and easily mistaken for a mere hillock, that rises above Outer Tagum's only harbor, and indeed only settlement, not counting the naval base on the other side. On top of this fourth sigra is the castle, that is the nominal home of Nigel St. John Glomthorpe, Wodemeyer, and that is to be the new headquarters of Detachment 2702. 5 minutes' walk encompasses the whole town. A furious rooster chases a feeble sheep down the main street. There is snow at the higher elevations, but just gray slush down here, which is indistinguishable from the gray cobblestones until you step on it and fall down on your ass.
The Encyclopedia Tagmiana has made much use of the definite article. The town, the castle, the hotel, the pub, the pier. Waterhouse stops in at the shithouse to deal with some aftershocks of the sea voyage, and then walks up the street. The automobile pulls up alongside and offers him a ride. It turns out to be the taxi, too. It takes him round the park, where he notices the statue. Ancient Tagmians thrashing hapless Vikings. This gesture that does not go unnoted by the taxi driver, who veers into the park to give him a better look. The statue is the sort that has a great deal to say and covers a correspondingly large expanse of real estate. Its pedestal is a slab of native basalt, covered on at least one side with what Waterhouse recognizes from the encyclopedia as Tagmian runes. To an ignorant Philistine, these might look like an endless random series of sans-serif X's, I's, V's, hyphens, asterisks, and upside-down V's. But it is an enduring source of pride to, "We didn't care for those Romans and that Julius Caesar fellow," observes the taxi driver. "And we weren't too taken with their alphabet either." Indeed, the Encyclopedia Tagmiana features a lengthy article about the local system of runes. The author of this article has such a chip on his shoulder that the thing is almost physically painful to read. The Tagmian practice of eschewing the use of curves and loops, forming all glyphs out of straight lines, far from being crude, as some English scholars have asserted, gives the script a limpid austerity. It is an admirably functional style of writing in a place where, after all, the trees were cut down by the English. Most of the literate intellectual class suffered from chronic bilateral frostbite. Waterhouse has rolled down the window so that he can get a clearer view. Apparently someone has lost the squeegee. The chill breeze washing over his face finally begins to clear away his seasickness, to the point where he begins to wonder how he should go about making contact with the whore. Then he realizes, with some disappointment, that if the whore has half a brain in her head, she's across the island at the naval base. "Who's the wretch?" Waterhouse asks. He points to a corner of the statue, where a scrawny, downtrodden loser with an iron collar welded around his neck and a chain dangling from that quivers and quails at the carnage being meted out by the strapping Tagmian he-men. Waterhouse already knows the answer, but he can't resist asking. "Hark!" blurts the taxi driver, as if he is working up a loogie.
"He is from Inner Tagum, I can only suppose."
"Of course." This exchange seems to have put the driver into a foul and vengeful mood that can only be assuaged with some fast driving. There are a dozen or more switchbacks in the road up to the castle, each one glazed with black ice and fraught with mortal danger. Waterhouse is glad he's not walking it, but the switchbacks and the skating motion of the taxi revive his motion sickness. The driver says, when they are about three-quarters of the way up, and nothing has been said for several minutes.
"They practically laid out the welcome mat for the Romans. They spread their legs for the Vikings. They're probably Germans over there now."
Speaking of bile, Waterhouse says, "I need you to pull over. I'll walk from here." The driver is startled and miffed, but he relents when Waterhouse explains that the alternative is a lengthy cleanup job. He even drives Duffel up to the top of the Sigga and drops it off. Detachment 2702 arrives at the castle some 15 minutes later in the person of Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse, USN, who is serving as the advance party. The walk gives him time to get his story straight, to get himself into character. Chatton has warned him that there will be servants, and that they will notice things, and that they will gossip. It would be much more convenient if the servants could simply be packed off to the mainland for the duration, but this would be a discourtesy to the Duke.
"Yeah, well," Chatton said, "have to work out a modus vivendi."
Once Waterhouse has looked this term up, he agreed heartily. The castle is a mound of rubble about the size of the Pentagon. The lee corner has been fitted out with a functional roof, electrical wiring, and a few other frills, such as doors and windows. In this area, which is all Waterhouse gets to see for that first afternoon and evening, you can forget you are on Outer Tagum and pretend that you are in some greener and balmier place,
such as the Scottish Highlands. The next morning, accompanied by the butler, Gidnix, he strikes out into other parts of the building and is delighted to find that you can't even reach them without going outside. The internal connecting passages have been mortared shut to stanch the seasonal migrations of skerries, the frisky, bright-eyed, long-tailed mammals that are the mascot of the islands. This compartmentalization, while inconvenient, will be good for security. Both Waterhouse and Gynix are encased in plank-like wrappings of genuine Tagum wool, and the latter carries the Galvanic Lucifer. The Galvanic Lucifer is of antique design. Gynix, who is about 100 years old, can only smile in condescension at Waterhouse's U.S. Navy flashlight, in the sotto voce tones one might use to correct an enormous social gaffe. He explains that the Galvanic Lucifer is of such a superior design as to make any further reference to the Navy model a grating embarrassment for everyone concerned. He leads Waterhouse back to a special room behind the room behind the room behind the room behind the pantry, a room that exists solely for maintenance of the Galvanic Lucifer and the storage of its parts and supplies. The heart of the device is a hand-blown spherical glass jar comparable in volume to a gallon jug. Gidnix, who suffers from a pretty advanced case of either hypothermia or Parkinson's, maneuvers a glass funnel into the neck of the jar. Then he rustles a glass carboy from a shelf. The carboy, labeled Aqua Regia, is filled with a fulminant orange liquid. He removes this glass stopper, hugs it, and heaves it over so that the orange fluid begins to glug out into the funnel and thence into the jar. Where it splashes out onto the tabletop, something very much like smoke curls up as it eats holes, just like the thousands of other holes already there. The fumes get into Waterhouse's lungs. They are astoundingly corrosive. He staggers out of the room for a while. When he ventures back, he finds Gynix whittling an electrode from an ingot of pure carbon. The jar of Aqua Regia has been capped off now, and a variety of anodes, cathodes, and other working substances are suspended in it, held in place by clamps of hammered gold. When Gynix gets his carbon whittled to just the right size and shape, he fits it into a little hatch in the side of this bowl and casually throws a Frankensteinian blade switch. A spark pops across the contacts like a firecracker. For a moment, Waterhouse thinks that one wall of the building has collapsed, exposing them to the direct light of the sun. But Gynix has simply turned on the Galvanic Lucifer, which soon becomes about 10 times brighter as Gynix adjusts a bronze thumbscrew. Crushed with shame, Waterhouse puts his Navy flashlight back into its prissy little belt holster and precedes Gynix out of the room, the Galvanic Lucifer casting palpable warmth on the back of his neck.
"We've got about 2 hours before she goes dead on us," Gynix says significantly.
They work out a modus vivendi, all right. Waterhouse kicks an old door open, and then Gynix strides into the room that is on the other side and sweeps the beam of the lantern around as if it were a flamethrower, driving back dozens or hundreds of squealing skeddies. Waterhouse clambers cautiously into the room, typically making his way over the collapsed remnants of whatever roof or story used to be overhead. He gives the place a quick inspection, trying to gauge how much effort would be required to make it livable for any more advanced organism. Half of the castle has, at one point or another, been burned down by a combination of Barbary corsairs, lightning bolts, Napoleon, and smoking in bed. The Barbary corsairs did the best job of it, probably just trying to stay warm, or maybe it's just that the elements have had longer to decompose what little was left behind. In any case, in that section of the castle, Waterhouse finds a place where there's not too much rubble to shovel out, and where they can quickly enclose an adequate space with a combination of tarps and planks. It is diametrically opposed to the part of the castle that is still inhabited, which exposes it to winter storms but protects it from the prying eyes of the staff. Waterhouse paces off some rough measurements, then goes to his room, leaving Gynix to see to the decommissioning of the Galvanic Lucifer. Waterhouse sketches out some plans for the upcoming work, at long last putting his hitherto misspent engineering skills to some use. He draws up a bill of required materials,
naturally involving a good many numbers. 100 8-foot 2x4s is a typical entry. He writes out the list a second time, in words, not numbers. 100 8-foot 2x4s. This wording is potentially confusing, so he changes it to 2x4 boards, 100 count, length 8 feet. Next, he pulls out a sheet of what looks like ledger paper, divided vertically into groups of 5 columns. Into these columns, he transcribes the message, ignoring spaces. 2x4 boards, 100 count, length 8 feet. And so on. Wherever he encounters a letter J, he writes I in its stead, so that joist comes out as I-O-I-S-T. He only uses every third line of the page. Ever since he left Bletchley Park, he has been carrying several sheets of onion skin paper around in his breast pocket. When he sleeps, he puts them under his pillow. Now he takes them out and selects one page, which has a serial number typed across the top and is otherwise covered with neatly typed letters like this. ATHOP COGNQ DLTUI CAPRH MULEP, and so on, all the way down to the bottom of the page. These sheets were typed up by Mrs. Tenney, an aged vicar's wife who works at Bletchley Park. Mrs. Tenney has a peculiar job which consists of the following. She takes 2 sheets of onion skin paper and puts a sheet of carbon paper between them and rolls them into a typewriter. She types a serial number at the top. Then she turns the crank on a device used in bingo parlors, consisting of a spherical cage containing 25 wooden balls, each with a letter printed on it. The letter J is not used. After spinning the cage the exact number of times specified in the procedure manual, she closes her eyes, reaches through a hatch in the cage, and removes a ball at random. She reads the letter off the ball and types it, then replaces the ball, closes the hatch, and repeats the process. From time to time, serious-looking men come into the room, exchange pleasantries with her, and take away the sheets that she has produced. These sheets end up in the possession of men like Waterhouse, and men in infinitely more desperate and dangerous circumstances all over the world. They are called one-time pads. He copies the letters from the one-time pad into the empty lines beneath his message. When he is finished, 2 out of every 3 lines are occupied. Finally, he returns to the top of the page one last time and begins to consider the letters 2 at a time. The first letter in the message is T. The first letter from the one-time pad directly below it in the same column is A. A is the first letter in the alphabet, and so Waterhouse, who has been doing this cipher stuff for much too long, thinks of it as being synonymous with the number 1. In the same way, T is equivalent to 19 if you are working in a J-less alphabet. Add 1 to 19 and you get 20, which is the letter U. So, in the first column beneath T and A, Waterhouse writes a U. The next vertical pair is W and T, or 22 and 19, which in normal arithmetic add up to 41, which has no letter equivalent. It's too large. But it has been many years since Waterhouse did normal arithmetic. He has retrained his mind to work in modular arithmetic, specifically modulo 25, which means that you divide everything by 25 and consider only the remainder. 41 divided by 25 is 1 with a remainder of 16. Throw away the 1, and the 16 translates into the letter Q, which is what Waterhouse writes in the second column. In the third column, O and H give 14 plus 8 equals 22, which is W. In the fourth, B and O give 2 and 14 equals 16, which is Q. And in the fifth, Y and P give 24 plus 15, which is 39. 39 divided by 25 is 1 with a remainder of 14. Or as Waterhouse would phrase it, 39 modulo 25 equals 14. The letter for 14 is O. So the first code group looks like TWOBYATHOPUQWQO. By adding the random sequence ATHOP onto the meaningful sequence TWOBY, Waterhouse has produced undecipherable gibberish. When he has enciphered the entire message in this way, he takes out a new page and copies out only the ciphertext, UQWQO, and so on. The Duke has a cast-iron telephone, which he has put at Waterhouse's disposal. Waterhouse heaves it out of its cradle, rings the operator, places a call across the island to the naval station, and gets through to a radio man. He reads the ciphertext message to him letter by letter. The radio man copies it down and informs Waterhouse that it will be transmitted forthwith. Very soon, Colonel Chatton, down in Bletchley Park, will receive a message that begins with UQWQO and goes on in that vein. Chatton possesses the other copy of Mrs. Tenney's one-time pad. He will write out the ciphertext first, using every third line. Beneath the ciphertext, he will copy in the text from the one-time pad. UQWQO, ATHOP. He will then perform a subtraction, where Waterhouse performed an addition. U minus A means 20 minus 1, which equals 19, which gives the letter T. Q minus T means 16 minus 19, which equals negative 3, giving us 22, which is W, and so on. Having deciphered the whole message, he'll get to work. And eventually, 2x4's 100 count will show up at the pier.